Welcome to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast. I'm Brett King.
And I'm Jason Henricks. Every week since 2013, we explore the personalities, startups, innovators, and industry players driving disruption in financial services.
From incumbents to unicorns, and from cutting-edge technology to the people using it to help create a more innovative, inclusive, and healthy financial future. I'm JP Nichols, and this is Breaking Banks.
Parents, and those who have parents, know that the relationship is nothing but a series of awkward conversations, bodily functions, the laws of attraction, personal responsibility for choices, choices while driving, choices about attending school, choices about imbibing, choices about taking on debt. Those conversations become all the more awkward, or might not even take place, when the parent isn't literate on the topic itself. Enter Kayvon and Kamari Chisholm, the father and son founders of Junior Wall Streeters, a nonprofit organization focusing on decreasing the wealth gap for disadvantaged groups. Kayvon grew up in a financially illiterate home. He wanted to make sure that was not something he passed on to Kamari. Let's talk with him now. Kamari, how old are you?
13 years old.
So tell me about your investment portfolio, because I'll be honest, I've had 33, 43, 53-year-olds on the show that I don't think can speak as articulately about putting together his investment portfolio. So I'm excited to learn about yours.
I have three ETFs and one stock. My three ETFs are QQQ, BTI, PEG, and my one stock is Zumiez.
PEJ.
PEJ.
PEJ. All right. So how'd you pick those?
Well, the reason I picked QQQ is because when I first started investing, I was looking at Amazon. I was like, okay, I'll buy a few shares for Amazon. Then look at the price and I was like, whoa, that is way out of my budget. I cannot buy Amazon.
Dad, I need a raise in my allowance. It's going for a good cause.
Yeah. So my dad was like, all right, let's look at some ETFs. So then I did some research and I found QQQ. QQQ is an ETF along with Amazon, also owns Facebook, Apple, Google, which is Alphabet, Tesla, and VTI actually owns similar stocks as QQQ. And you might be asking, oh, you have QQQ, why would you get an ETF that has the same similar stocks? But the reason I bought VTI is because VTI is about $100 or so less than QQQ. So I can buy more, because I originally wanted to buy more of QQQ, but my dad said I had to have some diversity. So I wouldn't want to put all my money in QQQ, because if QQQ has an off day, then that's a lot of money I'm losing. So I wanted to have some financial diversity. So I put about 3-4 shares in VTI.
Fantastic. So Kayvon, I have to ask as a parent here, how did this happen? Like, you know, like, how do I make sure I can replicate this, that Kamari can talk so articulately about, you know, the how and the why?
Actually, Kamari could tell you that story better than I can.
So one day about 3 years ago, 2.5 years ago, I was watching a YouTube video and I saw this YouTuber with a really shiny Lamborghini. I saw the car and I was like, and then after I watched the video, I went up to my dad's like, when I'm old enough to drive, will you get me that car? He said that he wouldn't get me the car, but he showed me how to invest in the stock market. So maybe when I'm old enough to drive, I'll be able to afford the car for myself.
I love that. Right? Done like a true lawyer. So, you know, out of this, I love the motto you guys created, a nonprofit, Junior Wall Streeter, empowering youth with financial wellness. Today's investors started yesterday. Where did the idea come from to start Junior Wall Streeter?
So the idea came from, basically, I came up with the idea because we started off with Black Wall Streeter Consultation Services, which is an investment club consultation service. We help individuals start an investment club. And our motto is building wealth through investment clubs. And So we were doing that for about 2 years, and we hit a roadblock, and we found out that the more we talked about investment clubs, people even thought it was a pyramid scheme, Ponzi scheme, and they were not familiar with investing in the stock market. So we really had to pivot, and we decided to start an education component. And I said, we need to save our youth. We need to teach our youth this information. And so we started focusing on the youth of this generation to get them to learn and start early. And so we picked up some steam, and now some. It's funny because we're getting more requests from adults that are interested in learning, want to take the same classes that the youth are taking. So that's really in our motto. Empowering youth, we know that the financial information is empowering. You know, I think it's having that information as early as possible. But also today's investor started yesterday. I added that slogan because I know the majority of African Americans are behind with financial information and investing, and we want to change that dynamic.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that. Some of the systemic issues and the gaps that you saw that needed to be addressed, you know, specifically along, you know, the lines of, you know, ethnicity and race, you know, because it's very clear if you look at the data that there are underlying issues, right, and the gaps that are there. But I'd love to hear from your experience and how you've tried to attack them in both the Junior Wall Streeters and the broader consulting, you know, that you've been able to do as part of this.
You remember the statistics?
25% of African Americans invest in wealth generating activities. And me and my dad read a study that said in Boston, the average African American's net wealth is $8 compared to white's net wealth, which is $171,000.
$247,000. Yeah, so our goal, as a family, right? People think that because I'm a lawyer, I'm wealthy. I'm a government lawyer, right? I work for the government. But as a family, we've had our family investment club for 17 years. And that's how we're probably going to pay for Kamari's college education, at least some of it, right? He's in private school now. So that's really how we able to afford that. Through our investment club, right? The proceeds that we've gained from that. And so we wanted to share that knowledge and just encourage underserved people to work together. So we know that many of us don't have the disposable income to invest alone. But if we invest together in a club, thereby pooling our resources together, decreasing the risk, and then invest in the stock market. But the major component and the changes we see is that, like last year, some of our campers, they're investing. They're investing in the stock market. They've and before their parents, and we want to continue that. You know, it's a lot of this information. Like I am a descendant. Financial literacy, illiteracy was passed down to me. So because my mom was financially illiterate and. Just didn't have the knowledge, and I didn't gain this knowledge till I was in college.
And well, I'm surprised they did it, even though you went to some great colleges. Yeah. They don't do a great job of instilling financial literacy either.
Yeah, no, I mean, I totally agree. My first semester of college, I had 3 credit cards. First month. But the only, when I say I became financially literate, since I was an economics major, I learned about investing in the stock market. Mm. So I won't even say I was like financially literate after I graduated, but I knew about investing.
Most college graduates learn about the financial literacy known as debt, both the credit card and the student loans. So you said two really important programmatic things, and I think, you know, it's really worth drawing out. So Jennifer Tesher from Financial Health Network, and I rail on this all the time, that financial literacy, you know, just doesn't work. But you've made it work, I think, through two very powerful sociological levers to it. First is the investment clubs. How do the investment clubs work, right? Because I think it's more powerful than just the fact that you've pooled the resources and kind of reduced the work. There's also some social pressure you know, to perform and to stick on it in a way that, you know, it's one of the most powerful aspects of Weight Watchers. You know, it isn't, you know, the food they give you so much as you've joined, you know, kind of this mission and have social accountability attached to it.
Yeah, that is very important. And we try to encourage individuals, family members and friends, at least 10 to 15 to get together, right? And the primary purpose of, to me, when I train individuals is become financially literate first. So you join a club and your monthly meetings are centered around different financial topics. It could be about insurance, like having life insurance, right? Or it could be about ETFs. So we do not encourage individuals to join a club right away to start investing. We want them to become, and sometimes when I work with clubs, I schedule a meeting. So I determine what the topics are. So it might be what is the stock market? So we try to teach them early on. And then after being in the club for 6 months to a year, they will start investing again. But it's like, you know, they may put in $100 a month, 10 individuals. So they might be saving for a year before they choose to invest in the stock market.
Okay. So then, Kamari, you can explain this. How do the summer camps work? You mentioned the camps, which the idea of an investing summer camp and you is really intriguing to me.
Well, what I do in the camps is I teach kids my age and some older kids how to budget their money and how to track their stocks. So I teach them how to track their stocks, which I like to say is invest or track in what you know. So I play a lot of sports. So I might be looking at Nike or Under Armour. I also play PlayStation. So I might be looking at Sony. So then I teach them invest in what they know, track what they know. And then with the budgeting, we have budgeting envelopes. And then, for example, I get about $20 every 2 weeks for chores. So I divide my money that I get in those envelopes into different envelopes.
Literal physical envelopes. I love it. The most effective budgeting system ever created.
Yeah.
And adored by grandmas everywhere.
Yeah.
Depending on what I'm saving, I'll put more money in one category. Maybe if I want to donate to charity for 1 week, I'll put more money in the donate. If I want to save up for more things that I want, I'll put money in the save envelope. But I'll just divide my money into different envelopes depending on what I want at the time.
Now, read this really interesting study in Coinbase that college-educated Black Americans are nearly twice as interested as college-educated white Americans in learning more about crypto. And then Cassie, our executive producer, said, yeah, Junior Wall Street, has crypto in its curriculum. What are you teaching about cryptocurrency and the approaches?
So, and that goes back to our slogan, right? Today's investor started yesterday. And crypto is really new to me. You know, at first I was really against it because, not necessarily against it, but I do well in the stock market by itself. And I'm not really prone because it's not regulated, so to say. So I was a little bit hesitant, right?
Yep.
But we want to just give people an introduction, right? So that's a new camp we added this year. Our basic camp last year was financial literacy and investing. So you asked that. So we start off with banking, budgeting, understanding credit, then we get into investing. And that part, you know, some people, when we taught adults, all they wanted to do is learn about investing. But the part we try to stress is you need to know about an emergency fund, right? That's a major issue in the African-American community is having money set aside. We do not bypass the basic financial literacy. And so this year, we're offering advanced stock analysis. Some of the parents wanted more math. So we added the advanced stock analysis has more math involved, and we add real estate. And then kids could understand just the basic of Forex and crypto, just to be familiarize themselves with how that works. And Kamari would be one of the first students in that class.
So you've mentioned the camps. How do people find out about the camps? And right, I'm assuming these are virtual camps now in the land of COVID.
Yeah, these are, again, last year we were trying to go in person, then COVID broke out. All these are virtual. You can go to our website, www.theblackwallstreeter.com, and you can register. New people to our program, new students have to take the basic financial literacy camp first, and then they could take the advanced courses. So we have alumni, and they're invited to take the they could take the advanced courses right away because they're already familiar with the basic stuff. We have to refresh their memory, but our website has all the camps available where you can take them.
So, you know, a lot of the listeners work within financial institutions and fintechs. If they wanted to get involved and support you along this mission, what kinds of partnerships or interests do you have in being able to work with other institutions?
Oh, that, you know, that's a great question, Jason. You know, when we started the nonprofit, I was encouraged for over a year to start this, right? And I was really hesitant because it's really only five of us doing this with my teachers. But what are unbeknownst to me, most of the nonprofits that we are looking at now, they require you to be invited to apply for a grant. So, I mean, we don't, like, how do they find out about us, right? So, so on our website, we have a donate button. You could donate, you could sponsor a camper. If you want to sponsor an instructor, we welcome guest speakers. If someone wants to come in and just speak to the kids during a session about the experience, because we also want to encourage more youth. And by the way, Jason, it's not just limited to African Americans. A person called me a racist, called our program racist on Facebook. Yes, this morning when I saw it. Undeserved youth. We don't discriminate against anyone. But so anyone who wants to come and speak, because we want to encourage more kids into the financial world. I mean, as a career. So we have guest speakers come in and talk about their experience about working in the financial industry, how it is. So we welcome that.
Yeah, but I mean, that is undeserved. And I think it downplays the importance of modeling in terms of what we see and what we do. We did an episode a little over a year ago called The Black Banker. And it had kind of the journey of one black and one brown banker in traditional banking, and then one in within financial advising. And them not even knowing those were careers open and accessible to them, because everyone they had met who kind of, you know, was doing that did not look like them, did not have their background. So this idea of, you know, there's a very similar set of research around women in investing, right?
Yeah. So
the reason more women hadn't been involved in investing, why we do need to, you know, make sure we curate those things. So as we close out our time together, first, Kamari, I'm curious, if you could invest in anything, you know, right now, like you had a bigger budget, you're a portfolio manager now, what else would you go out and buy?
Right now, I'll probably just invest more in the stocks and ETFs I have right now because they're doing well for me. But maybe with a couple more days and some research, I might invest in some of the stocks and ETFs that my dad's investment club has, because my dad has an investment club and they have more money than me. So they have the ability to make more money than me because they can put more money into stocks and ETFs. So I'll probably ask my dad for some ETFs and some stocks. And I might buy Amazon because I might look at Amazon. I might buy a risky stock like Tesla, but there's a lot of options.
You also looked at General Motors. You were looking at General Motors and Dollar Tree, a dollar store, something like that.
Yeah, I was looking at Dollar Tree and General Motors the last couple of weeks and tracking them. I'm not going to go with Dollar Tree because it hasn't been doing well, but I might think about going with General Motors.
So, Kevin, last question. What advice do you have for parents in terms of promoting this, not just financial literacy, but a healthy relationship with money and saving?
I would try to get them started early. We started Kamari at probably budgeting. We started Kamari at 9 when we first started giving him allowance for doing chores. So, and just having a conversation with your child about money. Sometimes I'll sit down with Kamari when I get paid and go over my bills. Like, what do we have to pay? So he's familiar with this is how this works. You know, this is how money works in his household, so that he's really familiar. If parents can afford it, I would say open up a custodial account for their child. So we started Kamari off with maybe $500 a couple of years ago. And, you know, he's sort of been building off that. You know, he won a speech contest a few years ago. And so he used that money to also to invest in. So I think the sooner you have conversations with kids, the better they'll be off in the long run.
Well, thank you both for sharing what you're doing. Once again, you know, people should check out if they want to speak, partner, send a camper, sponsor a camper, all at, it's the juniorwallstreeter.com.
www.theblackwallstreeter.com. You can click on the donate button or the Junior Wall Street button to learn more.
Fantastic. Well, thank you both for joining today.
Hi, my name is Dara Tarkowski. I'm the host of the Tech on Reg podcast at Provoke.fm. Tech on Reg explores all things at the intersection of law, technology, and highly regulated industry. We're talking about fintech and reg tech, cannabis, and sex tech. Join me and thought leaders from around the world to discuss how to pursue responsible innovation.
If you were asked to define financial security, what would you say? Go ahead, I'm waiting. I know for me, it'd probably be a pretty simple math equation, something like how much money do I have, how much do I owe, and how much is coming in to bridge the gap. Our next guest is Melissa Gopnik, Senior Vice President of the national nonprofit organization Commonwealth, which is focused on financial security and opportunity for financially vulnerable people through innovation and partnerships to actually change the systems. They recently completed an extensive study around financial wellness. And guess what? It turns out Jason's math is actually not the driving force between people's feeling of financial security. Melissa takes me through the four factors they find that do impact financial security and how they can partner with fintechs and financial institutions to drive better outcomes. Melissa, thanks for joining us today as we continue really delving into issues around wellness. To start, maybe you could tell us a little bit more about Commonwealth and, you know, what do you do and how'd you get started?
Absolutely. So Commonwealth is a national nonprofit organization. We were founded around 20 years ago, actually out of the Harvard Innovation Lab by Dr. Peter Tufano, who's still the chair of our board. And what we do is we really are in the business of coming up with innovative new financial products that'll help build the financial security and opportunity of lower income Americans who are disproportionately Black, women, Latinx. And we do that through innovation. We come up with new ideas, we test them in the real world in partnership with fintechs, and then we get them to scale again in partnerships with financial institutions, fintechs, and employers.
So you released a new study recently of, you know, close to 1,200 low to moderate income people and lots of individual interviews. What did that study uncover?
Right. So that study was really trying to look at the non-financial factors that impact people's financial security. So when you think about someone's financial health, you think about the numbers. What income do they have? What are their assets? What are their debts? And based on lots of our research, we knew there was an X factor, and we wanted to really uncover what that X factor was. And so that's why we undertook this research, to really try and look at what are the non-financial factors that impact people's belief in their ability to become financially secure.
And so is the belief the big part of that X factor?
So it's more complicated than that. It's really, we found kind of four different factors that impacted people's ability to believe that they could become financially secure. And what's fascinating for us is those four factors really depend on the design of the products that are in the system that they're in. So what products are made available by fintechs and financial institutions can have a significant impact on the kind of non-financial factors that help people become financially secure.
Can you tell us more about those factors? Are those well known at this point, or are they just becoming known?
I think it's a combination. So one of the things that we found was that it was important that people had a sense of financial security being a journey, that you're on a pathway to becoming financially secure. It's not just something that happens to you like that overnight, but that it's a long journey that has a start, that has you stumbling along the path sometimes, that you feel you're in control of, that you have agency over, and that you kind of have a hope and optimism that there's a positive endpoint of this journey. So that was one of the factors.
Okay. What's number two?
Number two is around aspirations and values. We all have aspirations and values regardless of our financial circumstances, and we are all motivated by those aspirations and values. Oftentimes when people talk to lower income Americans, they talk about what they don't have. What are your financial challenges? What is your debt? Rather than really focusing on their aspirations and values. And when people are messaged about that, they're much more likely to believe that they can actually become financially secure.
Interesting. And number three, what's the next factor that needs to be taken into account?
Yeah, I mean, this one is more broadly known, and that is that social networks matter. People who felt financially secure knew more people that they thought were financially secure. So the concept that you need to have an environment around you of people who have made it, people like you who have made it, make you feel more likely to believe that you can make it too.
So it's kind of the mirror of how important the visualization is related to professions, right? Like there's been lots of research come out now that if you see that people of a certain color are not doctors or lawyers or those professions, and you are a person of that ethnicity, you don't think that's accessible. You're saying that also translates over to this idea of financial wellness, that you need to see people around you who've attained financial wellness to feel like it is also a path available to you.
Exactly right. That's exactly right. We talked to a bunch of Black women about investing in the stock market, for example. We gave them some money and said, go invest in the stock market. And we asked them, why hadn't they done it? And they were like, investing? That's for, you know, white men with briefcases. That's not for people like me. I don't know anyone who has invested. So it's not something that I could possibly ever do.
Interesting. So what's the fourth factor?
The fourth factor is really one around inclusive messaging, that there's a sense of this is for me, that the messaging has to resonate with the mindsets that people have. So when we talk to lower income Americans and we talk about financial security, many of them say that it's a privilege that's not available to them. Like they don't manage their finances manage them. Mm. And so when fintechs talk to them about, oh, we can help you manage your finance, for them, they're like, who are you kidding? That's not me. You're not talking to me. That messaging is not inclusive. It doesn't include me. And so the real importance of people hearing messages that make them feel included, that they also could become financially secure.
Now, you called out specifically the Discover credit card TV ads is an example of inclusive messaging. Can you tell us more about what did they do that was different?
Yeah, I mean, I think what they did was they made it really visually engaging that we are exactly like you, right? It's the same actor who plays the customer and the service rep.
Yep.
And that really deeply sends the message that we here at Discover are exactly like you. We see you. We know you. We understand you. The tagline, in fact, treating you like you'd like to be treated, like that is so deeply about recognizing who you are.
So of these four factors, I think publishing is a great first step, but Commonwealth doesn't stop at that. You also develop solutions. So, you know, how do you go about, you know, bringing solutions to bear that, you know, really reinforce the journey mindset?
Yeah, so right now we're working with a bunch of different fintechs and we hope to work with more to test these ideas in the real world. In terms of what does the messaging need to be like? What are the product features that you need to have to support people having a journey mindset? So for example, if you can point out to people when they might be able to get on to the financial security journey. So what's happening in their lives? A raise, a new job, a new social situation, maybe married. And you can help them understand, like, oh, this is something that happened that can help you get onto a more positive financial future, for example. Or the negative as well. You notice they're missing bill payments. Can you have a product that notices that someone's missing a bill payment? And you can then proactively say, looks like you're stumbling on your journey. How can we help you get back on a path to financial wellness?
Interesting. So I love the approach that you're not just producing the research, but you're doing it in partnership you know, with a number of these fintechs. Now, are they all startups that you work with? And if someone wants to partner with you, you know, how do they get started?
They send me an email. So now we work with fintechs from, you know, early stage before they have any funding to when they're already in market. And we also work with mainstream financial institutions and large employers. So the whole gamut.
So let's start with the startups piece of this first, right? Whether they're a large, well-funded one or a new one. What's the biggest mistake you see them make when they kind of come in? Because especially within fintechs, you know, it's part of the brand right now that most are about some sort of social impact. You know, we did a show not long ago based on a Twitter survey that I put out that close to 70% of the respondents to the survey believed that a financial institution should have some sort of social impact in what it's doing, right? Which I knew it was going to be high. I didn't think it was going to be that high, right? So it's kind of built into the DNA of the fintechs. But what do they get wrong when they try and go approach it?
Yeah, I mean, I think we don't see that many fintechs who are intentionally designing for lower income Americans. And these are folks who are disproportionately women and Black and Latinx. That they don't understand that the needs, the wants, the aspirations of these customers are different and that you need to design for them. We see lots of fintech designing for young millennials, but very few who really have figured out the business model. And there is one that works to address the needs of these customers.
Yeah. Now, if you look upstream, what are the things that when you look at either the large employer groups or the incumbent financial institutions, what are they still getting wrong? Either because like we didn't understand it at the time or it becomes embedded.
I mean, I think an example of something that's embedded is the concept of overhead fees. Right? Mm. They have been charging overhead fees for large financial institutions for a very long time. And that's kind of built into some of their financial models right now. And they haven't understood the impact of those overhead fees and why there are other ways to generate income that improve the financial health of their customers. I think financial institutions are starting to think about financial health of their customers rather than simply transactional relationships with them. Mm-hmm. But it's still a long way that they have to go.
Now, a big part of this, I know part of Commonwealth's mission is it recognizes that a big part of it is actually the system has some flaws in design. What are some of those flaws you think that we need to begin to attack?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot. I think people sometimes don't know what we mean when we say systems. I think it's a word that people use a lot. Like people talk about systemic racism or systemic discrimination. And I think sometimes people have a hard time kind of grasping what systems mean. And I think that's why it's hard sometimes to see what the barriers are.
Yep.
I like to use a food metaphor because I'm a foodie. So what I choose to make for dinner tonight, for example,
okay,
is partly, very partly, only a little bit based on what I want to eat, right? It's based on what do I have in my fridge? And that's based on what supermarkets I can get to. It may be based on if I have enough money to go out to a restaurant and if there's one in my neighborhood pre-COVID. It might be based on what my husband and my daughter want to eat, right?
Yeah.
So it's very much little based on what I actually do or want. And the same thing is true with financial systems, right? That the landscape of products and services and experiences around me impact what financial choices I can make. And so that's why when we talk about systems, it's the whole system. It's what the products are. It's how they get distributed. It's how they get messaged. It's what is the historic relationship between a customer and that product. So it impacts both the income side from an employer perspective and also the debt side from a financial institution perspective.
One of those big pieces of debate oftentimes is the presence of branches in some of these neighborhoods. Where do you fall on that debate? You know, and I'll just call out, I am an anti-branch person that I think if, you know, we think that branches are going to solve some of these issues just by having a branch in the neighborhood. We're probably wrong, but I'd love, you are much more well-versed on this. And that's more just a philosophical pseudo-religious belief at this point for me in terms of the importance of the branch.
Right. I think that pre-COVID, I would have said absolutely branches are important because lower income folks have complicated lives and they like to have someone who they can talk to. We've done tons of surveys of folks to try and understand why they want to go to the branch. And it's because of the personal relationship. My life is really complicated and I need someone who I can explain my life to. What we've seen with COVID is people have had to go digital. So there's been a huge change in financial behaviors where many more lower income Americans are now transacting digitally through online banking. And I think the jury is still out whether that's meeting their needs or not.
So I'm curious, do you think those behaviors, you know, once people have gotten over that hump, it's going to stick?
That's, I think, the $10,000 question. I think it'll stick if the financial institutions figure out a way to still meet their needs for personalization. People with complex financial lives need customized, personalized services. And I'm not sure that all of the financial institutions have figured out a way to do that yet online.
And I would think online, to some degree, and again, adjacent soapbox, is we often confuse personable with personalized, right? That I come in and, you know, my golden retriever knows, you know, every branch that has treats in, you know, a 5-mile radius when we lived in downtown Chicago. And everyone was friendly and loved the dog and remembered the dog's name. But yet they also, you know, from a personalizing what they could do for me, even being a longtime customer, you know, they kind of forget that piece. I would think the ability for technology to actually, you know, micro tailor interactions with these people, like that should be part of the true power of the fintech when we talk about addressing these groups.
Absolutely. If the way that they personalize, if the algorithms that they're using to provide the personalization actually understand the financial lives of the folks that they're dealing with. We are doing a big survey around chatbots to try and understand, do chatbots work for lower income Americans? Or are the algorithms that are behind them designed based on data that doesn't kind of match the financial lives of lower income Americans? So absolutely, personalization would be great as long as the kind of the data engine behind it that's making the recommendations actually work for everyone.
Well, and that brings up another point that has come up on some of the episodes around user experience and design. A lot of the financial technology that is especially coming out of the epicenters of Silicon Valley and, you know, New York, Boston, where, you know, you're based, it's being driven by this kind of microcosm of a very white, very male dominated, you know, piece. And it was actually one of the co-founders of Boulevard had, you know, pointed out they're also the things that are getting the most funding because guess what? Venture capital also skews, you know, very white and, you know, very male and a level of affluence, right? So, you know, with the roots in the Harvard Innovation Lab, you know, how do we actually start to create more of these products and more resources around the designers of those products, whether it be the data or the differences in design? What kinds of work have you done there?
Yeah, I mean, so that's, you know, our roots are long ago now, 20 years ago in the Harvard Innovation Lab. I wouldn't want to get them in trouble here. But I think what we try and do is really prove that there's a business case for change. There's a business case to design for lower income Americans who are not, don't look like you and me, honestly, because they are a huge customer base that is not being served right now, right? If you think about it from a business perspective, wow, we have this huge millions upon millions of people who have financial needs and no one is meeting them in a good way.
Yep.
How can we not want to address that need?
Yeah.
But to do that, you need to listen, though. You need to really be open to understanding that they're not like you, that they have different financial lives. And so we do a ton of consumer research to really elucidate how different those lives are and to really amplify the voices of the financially vulnerable so that they can say to the designers out there, look at us. This is what we need. And if you provide it to us, we will come and use your app or come into your financial institution.
Well, What other resources do you recommend for learning about a segment that might not look like you or have the same experience as you? Because a lot of having prepared for this and looked at a lot of the project briefs that you've done, you know, those are very, very rich, you know, in terms of the types of journeys you talk about. Where else do you think that designers of the latest, you know, fintech app, whether it's within a startup or a large company, where else should they be looking for that sort of thing?
I mean, I think in the last year, there's been just so much more research that has been published around the needs of women, small business owners, Blacks, Latinx. I always think our website has the best research, but Prosperity Now has some great research as well. They're another national nonprofit, Prosperity Now. Neighborhood Trust is another group that we think has done some great work. In terms of fintech, SaverLife is one of our favorite because they really are a great example of how you can help people save, which we think is a cornerstone to financial security. Aspen Institute, the financial security project there, is also another great resource. They've issued some great research around debt recently. Yeah.
So if I were going to look on your phone right now, what financial apps would I find? And which one is, like, if I said you had to delete all but one financial app, what would that be?
So I actually have no financial apps because I have a very old phone. I'm afraid I'm one of those old people. And that's not totally true. I have Venmo. I do have Venmo because I have a 17-year-old daughter and she needs money. So I do have Venmo. But that is the only app, and I've tried them because that's my business, and they just are too hard for me to use. They require me to input too much information. My husband has his own business, so we have complicated financial life, and so trying to get that all in one app has just not worked for me.
Now, do you, from an online perspective, if it's not on the phone, have you, what tools do you use, you know, in the browser then?
Yeah, no, I do online banking. I pay all my bills online so that I don't have to worry about missing bills. So all of my bills are automatically paid.
Got it.
That's something I have the luxury of doing because I have a paycheck that's the same every 2 weeks.
Well, I mean, this brings up an important point. What do you think the industry gets wrong about thinking about improving people's financial lives? Because you've hit one of the hot button issues there.
Yeah, I think making things automatic is just not always good for people. If your take-home pay, if I work at Target and my hours vary week by week, so some weeks I make $100 and some weeks I make $200, having an automatic bill pay doesn't work for me. I need to have control and choice so that I can manage my financial life better. And also, when I make a decision for myself, I make the choice to do something, it empowers me to continue to make choices that are good for me. So automatic is great, and clearly simple and easy is super important. But if your financial life is complicated, having that sense of empowerment to make decisions for myself is incredibly important.
Well, pushing back a little bit on that, though, getting people to make decisions is hard, right? You know, when I was at Berk Street, we did lots of research on this, that people panic about making the wrong decision. And it is a lot easier to kick that can down the road, right? The aversion of a wrong choice today seems more painful than the wrong choice tomorrow. So I'm just going to keep kicking that down the road until I'm many years past the, boy, wish I was putting $5 in my 401k for, you know, every week for 25 years. How do you find that balance, right? Because you're right, you do need agency and you do need control and the practicality of, you know, the easy decision if I, you know, work at Target and my hours fluctuate is I can't afford to save anything. But if it's a week by week choice, I probably never make the choice to save as much as I should or to start a 401k. Where do you find the balance?
I think that you find the balance by making the choices much clearer for folks, by trusting their judgment, by saying, you know, yes, you should save, because if you save, that means you can repair your car next time it goes out and you won't have to not go to work anymore. So I think we just need to get better at providing information to people in ways that work for them so that they can make the best decisions for themselves. Because I trust that most people, given the right information and choice architecture will absolutely make the right decisions for them in that moment.
I mean, that architecture piece of this is one of the most important, where understanding the mindset of that person and in their journey and the beliefs they have around it is so important. We had Dan Egan on from Betterment not that long ago talking about choice structuring, and context is everything related to that.
Absolutely. So I would always want to provide people choices rather than making it automatic. That is what I would say to that, because the unintended consequences of choices are so positive that it's worth the little bit of friction that a choice versus an automatic decision makes.
So what last piece of advice would you give for anyone looking to build products or applications for the LMI world?
Talk to your customers, understand what their needs are today, but also what their aspirations are for their future, and really build products that are based on those aspirations and values, that include a social network component, because that's so important to them. And that really helps them get on the journey to financial security.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for joining us, Melissa. If people want to learn more about Commonwealth, where should they go and how can they get in touch with you if they want to partner?
They should email info@buildcommonwealth.org, and our website is buildcommonwealth.org.
Fantastic. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's it for this week. If you like the show, make sure to give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform, or share it with a friend, or share it on social media.
We'll see you again next week with more Breaking Banks.